are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast this week is Jatin Patel, Director Inclusion and Diversity at England Rugby. Prior to joining RFU, Jatin worked for DLA Piper and KPMG UK.
Good afternoon, Jatin. Thank you for being a guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast today.
My pleasure. And good morning to you, Tudor. Good to see you.
Good evening, actually.
Oh, good evening. Of course it's evening. I knew that. Good evening, Tudor. Good to see you.
Okay, so let's get started with a quick introduction to who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I'm Jatin Patel. I'm the Inclusion and Diversity Director at the RFU, which is the England Rugby Football Union. Been in post now just over 2 years. And in terms of what I do, I think the simplest way of describing the way I do my role is across kind of four critical pillars. We look at how we can build a more inclusive and diverse approach to employees and board, so the organisation. I describe that typically as your very quintessential IND role. So everything in relation to the employee life cycle, from attraction approaches to recruitment to progression and retention of staff, and ensuring the journey for everyone is equitable, but also that we are constantly looking to diversify our staff body. The second pillar is gameplay. So for rugby and for me, that means everything from grassroots community rugby all the way through to the top of our senior squads, both for men and women, and the pathways that sit in between them. So trying to get more people playing the game, understanding the experiences they're having from an inclusivity perspective, and making sure that we can make them as welcoming and positive as possible. But it's not just players, it's also match officials. We need more referees. Yeah. There's been a lot of talk about the impact on referees in rugby in particular at the moment, and also coaches. We need coaches from all different backgrounds to not only role model inclusive behaviours, but also inspire the next generation of talent from different backgrounds becoming coaches. So that's gameplay. The third pillar is game leadership. So we are a governing body. We have constituency bodies based around the country, pretty much reflecting different geographies. And we also have a council, which is our chief decision-making body. And ultimately, it's trying to build more inclusivity into the way they make decisions, the way they approach their respective leadership roles, but also diversify the talent pipelines behind them, so more people from different groups and backgrounds are able to become leaders themselves within the game. And then the fourth one is fans, followers and partners. So I try to describe that as, who are our fans? How do we get more of them? What is the content we're using to sell the game? So a reflective and honest picture of what the game is, but also one that entices people to want to be involved in rugby. But then also working with our corporate partners. So VMO2, one of our biggest ones, they're on the front of our shirts. We have a host of others like Honda and British Airways, etc. And working with them to align and collaborate and achieve mutually beneficial IND objectives. They're obviously large organisations. They have a number of areas of focus for them, which is similar to ours. They're trying to scale up our objectives and ambitions, but working together to make it meaningful and cohesive. So it's quite a long explanation of what I do, but that keeps me busy most of the time.
My God, I bet it would keep you busy. That's a huge remit. It sounds hugely challenging too. So as a second generation British Asian, we spoke earlier at the conference when we met last year and you were speaking about your parents, etc. How important is your identity to you and what does it mean?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I sometimes struggle to answer it, if I'm honest, because my heritage is incredibly important to me. My parents came over from India when they were very young, with not very much. And so they were kind of learning the ways of being British whilst also being strongly Indian. And I was very fortunate. Whilst I was born in South London, which is a very diverse part of the country, I then spent most of my upbringing in Brighton. And up until recently, I've always kind of struggled to kind of connect the two, because Brighton's not the most ethnically diverse part of the country, but it's an incredibly liberal, wonderful place. And I was actually listening to a podcast the other day with Munya Chihuahua, and he talked a bit about his own upbringing in Zimbabwe and then moving to Norfolk and rural Norfolk. And And you kind of nailed it in a way, because I kind of spent my formative years, like when I was at university, suddenly meeting more Asians that weren't my family, yeah. and understanding a bit more of what your typical second generation experience and upbringing in Britain was like. And so I had to kind of find that identity. But what it means to me is that I can't pretend I'm the most religious, but faith plays a big part of my culture and my family culture. It constantly drives me. I support England in every sport except cricket, because if I didn't support India at cricket, I think my family would disown me. But I think that's okay. You can straddle multiple yeah. cultural identities and still be proud of each and strongly patriotic to each. And so it means an awful lot, and it's definitely defined me. But sometimes I kind of struggle to properly identify myself, if that makes sense.
I can imagine. I struggle with it so much. So I can't imagine what that struggle is like for the second generation. Because at some point we start looking at our roots. It's not always important, but at some point it helps to give us a lot of answers. And I think yeah. to make peace with who we are and what we do.
Yeah, it's a real dichotomy, if I may say that, because it's like you grow up here, you're British Indian. Because of the color of my skin, it's obvious that you're from an Asian background.
Yeah.
And then every time I've gone back to India, not necessarily when I was younger, but certainly when I was kind of an adulthood, you're seen as British. It's like, you're not Indian, you're British. And you're kind of like, hang on, where am I meant to belong here? And I don't, you know, it's not a massive problem to have in life, but at the same time, it does cause a little bit of a separation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Moving on, I hear this all the time, that let's make a business case for DEI. B or DIBA or whatever you'd like to call it. That's the first thing everybody wants to talk about. Have you not moved? Should we have not moved beyond that?
Mm-hmm. Look, I think data is important. I think building cases for change is always important. Any person working in sort of change management needs to build cases for it. I think from an EDI perspective, I think the continued call for business cases for this agenda, I think are dated. I think ultimately, if you're searching for a business case to become a more inclusive organization, I think you're missing the point about what the entire agenda is about. And for me, it's about people. It's about human beings and ensuring you can capture and engage as much talent as possible. And that requires you to look beyond your traditional lenses. And so if you need financial business cases to do that, then I think you're kind of missing the point of the fact that actually the drivers of your commercial and financial success are the people who work for you and the work that they do, and them doing it to a high standard. And therefore, if you're already casting a wide net in terms of talent and engaging as many diverse populations as possible, and you're reaping the rewards of that, there's no need for a business case. So yeah, I think the continued ask for a business case is, I think we're definitely past that. That said, I don't think any organization is doing this perfectly. And I think sometimes the constant need to reflect on the business case sometimes creates a bit of a barrier and a blocker to actually yeah. seeing impacts and success over time. So I think we need to move entirely away from the business case, because it's still important to reflect on the data and the impact that your programs are having, but move more towards what's next. How do we make sure we continue this in a sustainable way and it doesn't become just a short-term project? And unfortunately, there are organizations that do look at it as a sort of, if we do this mentoring scheme, if we introduce these apprenticeships, if we do this, then we'll see some change in a short amount of time. Actually, how do you make it meaningful and strategic over time and align it to everything that your organization is trying to achieve, rather than as a separate sort of approach or agenda or action plan or strategy that sits alongside your broader objectives?
Yeah, because this way, when you need to make a business case every year or to justify your existence every year, sometimes it's the easiest thing to axe and do away with. And so we segue into the next question. Do you believe that we have lost the momentum from 2020 and that progress has stalled? Because last year we were speaking about the Kantar report, and that showed that globally it was stalling.
Yeah, and I think, so over the last couple of years, lots of organizations, as we saw post the horrific killing of George Floyd, the growth of the Me Too movement, we're in a very unique place globally as a result of the pandemic. And a lot of organizations recruited ED&I practitioners new. So, and they used those instances as a large part of the narrative behind why they were doing it. And some of it was ultimately bandwagon to some extent. So, well, if my competitor's doing it, or if that organization's doing it, we need to do the same. And in a way, it's almost built on a false premise. And it kind of speaks to the cycle of ED&I issues, which have gone around for years and years and years. And it's like, you know, not to diminish what happened in 2020, nor to diminish the efforts that a lot of people in this space make, but it's almost like organizations look at it, what is the important social issue of the month,
yeah,
or the year, and we'll focus on that in the here and now. I don't think we're necessarily across the piece losing momentum, but I think we are in another one of those challenges where we're having to justify why this work is important. And if I go back to a point I've made previously, it's important because it's about people, it's about human beings, it's about organizational culture, it's about people driving the success of organizations, regardless of what sector you work in. And that has to be strategic and sustained over time. And so, yes, I can see organizations cutting resource or even cutting departments in this space, but they're doing so, I would say, unfairly, because the change that we as practitioners in this world are trying to drive takes time. It doesn't happen immediately. Yeah, there are quick wins, but if all your focus is on the short-term stuff, then you're just ignoring the longer systemic institutional issues that are not 3 years old. They are hundreds of years old in most institutions and organizations, particularly in a country like Britain and also in the United States. And then if you look at it from a global perspective, I think one of the challenges has always been, and you're starting to see differences here, because the growth of D&I as an agenda and also the quality of practitioners in other parts of the world is very much focused on what is culturally nuanced in those respective countries, so be it in Asia, be it in Africa, be it in the Middle East, which is right. And again, that speaks to the broader issue here, which is there is no one size fits all. No. There is no one approach that works for a country, let alone the organizations that are operating in those respective nations. So yes, I can feel the pain of practitioners and feel that sense of momentum being lost and resources being cut. But given the secular nature of diversity and inclusion issues, there'll be no doubt, unfortunately, that something bad will happen again and organizations will go, well, yeah, we do need to put effort and focus on this. And almost you have to, you know, to the outside world, it'll feel like you're starting again, but actually all it's doing is allowing practitioners who are doing this and been doing it for a long time to gain that buy-in from their respective leaders to carry on with the work they probably set out to do much, much, much further in advance than when the issue happened itself.
Yeah. Jatin, you know, from what I've heard you speak and I've read some of the stuff, you seem like a glass half full rather than glass half empty. So you do like to see the positives also. So from that point of view, do you see that some progress has been made and that leaders can still get this back on top of the agenda?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, there are organizations, you know, large, high-profile organizations in a multitude of sectors who are doing some incredible work. And I think one of the really interesting things is that if you ask most, let's take corporate leaders, for example, whether ED&I is important, and actually take sport for a great example, if you speak to the leaders within our organizations, they absolutely will talk about the importance of ED&I, the importance of inclusivity. They understand the nuance of and the difference between inclusivity and diversity. And the need as well. I think where some of the challenge probably remains is that whilst we have more leaders openly talking about the importance of this stuff, perhaps it hasn't seeped through to those middle layers of management who actually do the day-to-day recruiting, who oversee the day-to-day cultures of organizations, who are ultimately the gatekeepers to seeing equitable progression within organizations, etc. I talked about earlier, so not to be hypocritical, but the importance of having a strategic approach is absolutely there. But then sitting behind that needs to be clear delivery plans and buy-in at all levels of an organization. It shouldn't just be the underrepresented groups through employee networks, whatever it might be, pushing from the bottom. It can't just be the leaders at the very top, because I genuinely believe that the vast majority of them are bought in. It's that large chunk of people in senior management positions inside organizations who, you know, yes, they've got really busy jobs, they've got huge remits, they've got KPIs they need to hit. I get all of those things. But if they aren't enacting the behavioral changes that most ED&I practitioners are championing, if they're not doing it in a meaningful way, which is reflective and focused on their respective organizations, if they don't know the tactics they need to apply themselves and the role and responsibilities they have, that's where this stuff falls down. And I'm not saying I'm doing it perfectly. I don't think anyone has the secret sauce, but that's certainly the way I try to look at it. And it's the way ultimately being in this job is about influencing. And I think a lot of leaders have realized that EDI leads are influencers. They use knowledge and expertise and data to drive suggested ways of changes, but they understand that they can't do it themselves. And I think it's that layer below where people do need more help because perhaps they're a bit more stretched, that we need to close that gap of understanding that EDI practitioners are not there to do the job, they're there to help you and enable you to do the job, to be more inclusive and therefore see diversity foster and succeed as a result of it. So yeah, sorry, it's a quite a long answer, quite wordy. It's just getting below the level of that strategy and getting into the principles and actions that people can take to drive change, because the sum of all those parts will hopefully breed success.
You've answered it incredibly well. You know that EDI leaders are influencers, also that they're not there to do your job, right? They're there to show you how you can do the job better and be more inclusive every day. Because if they were to do the job, they'd probably have to be the, I don't know,
I would agree. And if I may add, I think there's another challenge here, and this is probably one for us as EDI practitioners, is that I think most people doing this kind of work understand there isn't a one-size-fits-all, but there isn't even within organisations a one-size-fits-all approach. And we can't understand the detail and expertise that our colleagues who are niche and have, you know, are specific in their role have, but we need to try at least to understand how those individuals do their job, what they're trying to achieve, and we have to be tailoring and bespoking our approaches in response to that. I know we tend to be quite small teams, if not lone rangers in this space, but if you truly want to try and see change, you have to try and adapt it to what your respective departmental heads and their teams are trying to achieve, and understand what they're doing at the same time. But, you know, in sport, I'm not going to go and tell coaches at a very senior level how to coach rugby better. I'm not at all equipped to do that. But I can try and understand the environment and what they're trying to achieve in terms of their objectives and adapt my approach based on that, in constant conversation. So strategy is really important, but the ability to flex them and course correct them and evolve them over time is, I think, equally important.
Yeah, I think you've made a really good point, because there are a lot of EDI leaders who talk at people. I think there is a moral high ground and a sort of a superiority, and you're already feeling defensive because you don't understand the business or the BU head or what their function heads and what they're doing or what they're grappling with. And I think that understanding is very, very critical for success, if there has to be success. So moving on to sports and rugby in particular, I read an article that said that one of the biggest challenges facing English rugby is the class issue. And social mobility is sort of the elephant in the room when we talk about EDI, DIB, whatever you call it. Would you agree?
I would agree that we have a perception issue. And I think rugby is a very well-established, deeply historic sport in England in particular. You know, the country invented it. I'm fortunate to be able to work at the home of rugby on a regular occurrence. And I think we definitely have a perception issue that the game is elitist. And I think if you're an objective observer and you were to go to Twickenham this weekend and we play Wales in the Six Nations, you might, you know, from the cost of the ticket to the experience within the stadium, I can understand why there's that perception. I also can understand it from the perspective of the fact that there are a large swathe of people who make decisions in the organisation who are either volunteers, mostly volunteers, I would say, tend to be focused around the southeast of England, which tends to be a more privileged part of the country. But all of that said, I also feel like in terms of the spread of the community game and, you know, the clubs that are playing up and down the country, be it from the north all the way down to the southwest of England, you see a real range of people from different social backgrounds playing the game. And so I think we've got this tension, and also to your point about being always half glass full, opportunity to just create a narrative which is better reflective of the game that we have, which I think is more socioeconomically diverse than perhaps people from outside of the sport would think. And also then try to engage more communities from those backgrounds as well, from a more typically working class background, because that perception is strong, it's deep rooted, it's not entirely unfair, but I think it's not entirely accurate at the same time as well. And then on the other side of it, you know, a lot of players who end up playing at the elite end of the game of rugby do come through the system having attended private schools. And I think private schools who have rugby provisions are doing a wonderful job ultimately, because they're putting on a provision that's really needed, and they do end up providing a number of players that end up going into the elite end of the game. But at the same time, rugby faces a number of other challenges, because we're not on the national curricula, so not many schools will play full contact rugby at state school level, as much as we want to be able to lobby the government to be able to get that provision changed. And we're working on that, we're creating different formats, be it non-contact, which is starting to have some cut through. But until that does, if we can't have rugby being played in all its formats, in every school, in every community in the country, then that perception and, unfortunately, systemic elitism will remain. And outside of that, it's difficult for community clubs to pick up that burden by themselves. So in short, what I'm trying to say is it's a collective effort. Cricket suffers a similar sort of perception issue as well and has its same similar sort of systemic challenges within England. And it's important for the kind of the sporting world collectively to kind of try and address that lack of access and provision and engagement, particularly at school age, that can then reverse some of that sort of elite pipeline to the top end of the game. But I don't think it's entirely true, but I'd be naive to say that it's not definitely an issue we have.
And I guess unless it's on the national curriculum and it's accessible at state school levels, it'll be difficult to change.
Absolutely, yeah. And look, I also think it's important to know that if you look around the country, we look at the community clubs that we have, we've got minis and junior section everywhere that are thriving. You have young people playing non-contact rugby all over the country on a Sunday, thousands of young people. And there's a challenge and an opportunity that we have, which is to keep them in the game. And if rugby isn't being played in schools and it's only being played in community clubs on weekends, it's understandable you start to see a level of attrition, which is negative. But being the forever optimist, I think this sport teaches values. It's incredibly inclusive when you're on the pitch. We do have some behaviours which are kind of sometimes questionable and do need to change. And I think they are. But the people in rugby are incredibly passionate about the sport and sell it incredibly well. Our challenge and opportunity as a team and as an organisation is to spread that message and hopefully catch more people.
Yeah, that's very interesting, especially what you spoke about the perception issue. So I'll keep that in mind. Moving on to the next question. So racism, of course, continues to be deeply entrenched within the sports or within sports in general. What are the steps that institutions are taking to curb it internally? Yeah. And how can you tackle the behavior amongst fans and influencers, because this is totally external?
Yeah, sure. I'll take that in two halves then. I think in terms of what we're doing internally in the game of rugby, so we had a quite high profile incident of racism reported by Luther Burrell last year. And what we did at the elite end of the game was to try and understand through research and insight gathering to what extent that experience that he shared very bravely was being experienced by other players at the top end of the game. And what that gave us was a baseline of understanding the scale of experiences of racism. And it really did vary from microaggressions to being othered within changing rooms to difficulties going through the pathways, all the way through to the more overt experiences of racism. And I think what we discovered was actually the overt stuff is easier to manage and deal with, because if you can call it out straight away, then you can solve it. It's those behavioral microaggressions which add up over time and have a really negative cumulative effect. So what we've tried to do to address a lot of that, and I should say, through that insight gathering, it wasn't just racism that came out. The issues of sexism and misogyny within the game and also classism became quite apparent. So it isn't one-dimensional. And so what we've tried to do, what we have done, I should say, is ourselves, the two premierships, so the men's premiership and the women's premiership, as well as the Rugby Players Association, collaborated together to develop an elite game inclusion diversity plan, which is for all of rugby at the highest level. And you know, this is not to cast any aspersions on other sports, but we're trying to do it as a collective as best as we can. It's not always easy, but we all have the same intent and we want to achieve the same objectives. And a lot of what we have delivered, I should say, is education to the clubs, to players, focused on being a better active bystander, understanding the impact, albeit even if your intent isn't malicious, but the impact of your words and behaviours on each other, to create more inclusive cultures, regardless of the background that you're from, be it an ethnic minority or from a low socioeconomic background, or if you're a woman in the game of rugby. And we've delivered to men's game, we're halfway through delivering to the women's game, and there's a continuous number of other actions we're going to take. And a lot of it, we're in kind of an awareness raising phase at the moment, and the next stage will be building out club by club approaches to this, because like I mentioned earlier, there's no one size fits all, there's no one culture. And ultimately it's in the interests of our clubs at the high end to set the standard that they wish to see and the objectives they want to achieve. At the community end, there's thousands of clubs and thousands of players across the game. And again, we've taken quite a hard education approach to raise awareness of intent and impact of words and behaviours and what's right, what's wrong, the importance of language. But then we've also been working to develop leaders from an IND perspective within our regional bodies. We call them constituency inclusion diversity leads, who are challenged and set the task of building localized plans. But it's a long process. And like I said, whilst I can't say I'm new anymore, I'm 2 years into it. And our intention is to make long-term sustainable change, which is focused on inclusivity for now, with a view in time that once we have better inclusive cultures, that we can better serve diverse communities, because our cultures and behaviours are right at the foundations are there for those from different backgrounds to not only feel welcome within the sport, but also succeed and be the best they want to be.
Yeah, it's not as easy. And I'm sure there's lots of work that needs to go into it. But at least you started on the journey and you're trying to make an impact. And I think, as you're mentioning, there is a coherent strategy amongst all the bodies, the important bodies. Is there any initiative or advocacy campaign in particular that you are proud of, Jatin?
Yeah, I mean, look, I wish we could have done more. I would say, I mentioned the Elite Game Plan. Bringing those entities together was a really important step and moment for us. And as we continue to deliver, we'll hopefully see as well wholesale change at the top of the game. I wouldn't say we've done loads of major campaigns. I've spent the 2 years I've been in this role doing is just getting parts of the organization to understand and think about diverse audiences and the importance of inclusivity in what they do. And we're actually going to be publishing our first impact report in the coming weeks, which is pretty comprehensive. And we've made a number of changes in the way our coach developers coach, in the way that our people who work in rugby development go out into the community game and help committees and clubs be more inclusive. So it's a lot of the small changes that hopefully, when you add them all together, we'll see larger change over time. So it's probably a cheat answer to say I'm proud of all of it. We've not really landed any massive campaigns, and that's kind of on purpose. It was quite intentional, because I think one of the bits of feedback we got from particularly the Elite end of the game last year was that the things that we tried, particularly around 2020 and 2021, was that it felt quite performative, particularly when we had the work around Black Lives Matter and trying to raise awareness. A lot of players told us that they felt it was performative. It wasn't backed up by actual change in action. So I've taken that as a bit of a sort of mantra and gone, right, let's just get all the foundation, sow all the right seeds and cultivate them as we move forward.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a better approach to actually getting something done and addressing some of the systemic issues, rather than just, you know, being tactical and opportunistic. Yeah. So how do you ensure accountability and measure progress? You've spoken about data. How important is data, and how easy or difficult is it for you to collate data? Because these groups of people are like fairly diverse, and it's not simple to get all of it together.
No, agreed. And so data is really important. I always say behind every data point is a person, is their life story. So we have to remember the qualitative side of it as well as the quantitative side of it. How difficult has it been? So we are working our way towards having a more comprehensive data set for the game. We're hoping we can get some changes made this year that allows us to understand the diversity of the community game of rugby as a whole, as well as the top end. But that's not as simple as we'd like. Within an organization, for example, you have your internal HR system. People are employed and therefore contracted to your organization. Obviously, they don't have to respond to those questions, but you have a kind of confined space within which to market and communicate why collecting this information is important, how it's being used, and what it drives in terms of an organizational IND strategy and plan. For us, you know, the community game are volunteers. They're not employed by the RFU. They are people who enjoy the game and make a choice to play the sport. So we have to be a bit more delicate in our approach, and hopefully we'll land that right when we make those changes to our internal game management system at the end of this season, ready for the next. That said, you know, data for the organization in terms of our staff is definitely improved, and we're able to monitor changes now. We've instigated a number of surveys, which is kind of sentiment gathering, which are seeing more respondents each year. And a lot of the insights we gather from that drives our year-on-year delivery plan. So you always want more data. And I think we're doing the best with what we have. And I think after the next season, hopefully when I speak to you this time next year, I'll be able to tell you we've got much more data at the community game, which will be really effective in driving change over time. In terms of accountability, so that we've got pretty healthy governance structure around our plan. My executive essentially are the steering committee for the organizational IND action plan. They're all very, very engaged. I report directly into our CFO, COO, which makes a big difference, by the way. I don't sit in the HR team. I sit in the business operations team, which means I get to work across everything and have the freedom and flexibility to do so, which makes a real, real significant difference. And so we have accountability from the top. We've got an external advisory group with people from within and outside of rugby who bring real check and challenge to how we approach things. And even within our council, we have an IND working group who drive change from amongst those leaders within the game. So there's loads of groups of leaders who are entrusted to drive the objectives and the actions and the things that we've set out, which comes with challenges because some are volunteers, some have very big jobs and remits, etc. But at least it allows me and the team the ability to keep this on the agenda and make sure that we're looking at it in a strategic way.
I am impressed with what you've said, that you don't sit in HR.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite typical, isn't it? And I think, and I can understand why. Every role I've had in this space prior to working here was working out of a people department or an HR team. And there is value, absolutely, because you get to influence the employee life cycle. But I think you start to struggle when you're trying to influence beyond. So when you're trying to influence leaders in terms of the way they operate commercially and how they engage with clients, etc., it becomes more difficult when you're doing that out of HR. Whereas I mentioned earlier, the four pillars we work across, I wouldn't be able to work across those four pillars if I were solely working out of the HR team. Yeah, so absolutely. I work very closely with them. They're a wonderful team and I really do enjoy working with them, but it's a very different kind of EDI role, which is quite refreshing.
Yeah, I think it limits your mandate otherwise. So how important are role models to progress DIB in rugby and sports? I mean, we know that role models are critical.
Yeah, no, I think they're really important. And, you know, we're fortunate, particularly if I look at the England senior men's team, it's a pretty diverse group. And we've got a number of high profile role models in that sense. You know, if you've got Ellis Genges, your Maro Tojes, you've got Courtney Laws, who just retired, and Jason Robinson before, you know, all these wonderful people of colour who are amazing role models for the game and even women's game. You know, you've got Shauna Brown, who's amazing, by the way, and Sadiqa Bayer playing now, Tatiana Hurd, etc. But I think one of the challenges I have with role models is they're great to have. They're really important. They're important for rugby because we need to, more people from different backgrounds falling in love with the sport and wanting to play it. But I also feel like we need to collectively, and the majority within organisations, need to understand the responsibility they have to drive greater inclusivity and therefore diversity of audience, diversity of employees, diversity of participants. Because when you don't have many underrepresented groups within your organisation or within your sport, giving the task to the same individuals to be the face of diversity, the face of change, is exhausting, because it shouldn't fall on those individuals to be the sole drivers of that change, even though I'm sure all of them, I know in rugby they all do have a deep passion to change and improve the diversity of the sport. But let's not forget, they weren't at all responsible for the state of the game as it is today. They are in the positions they are in spite of the barriers and the systems that they've come across to get to where they are. And I often say this to colleagues and volunteers who, when they've got a good intent and they're like, well, I think we need diverse people to be driving this program or that activity, I always remind them that's like, well, you know the game, you know the sport, you know it brilliantly well, you talk about it passionately, you sell it brilliantly. Don't underestimate the power you have as a white middle class man to sell the game of rugby to a new community, because no one knows it better. And I think there's a getting the balance right between good role models, a range of them, not just sweating the ones that you have over and over again, but ensuring that everyone understands their responsibility to be a role model and to be inspirational in attracting people to the sport and selling the sport, because otherwise we're going to be here for ages. We're going to be doing this for another 50 years.
Agree. I mean, I think it's a huge burden on underrepresented communities that they may be passionate about the advocacy they do, but for them to do all the hard work, it is like setting them up for failure. I think everybody, I guess, has to role model behaviors that are like role model worthy and be more inclusive. And I think the power of people, the majority, I don't think we should undermine that. Most people, I believe, are good people.
I couldn't agree more. And I also think, you know, in rugby, the men's game is more established. It's been around, I'm not going to say it's been around loads longer, but it's been kind of professional for a lot longer and has received more resource and time investment and fans over time. The one thing I think I find really refreshing about the growth of the women's game in England is if you look at the way that the new league has promoted itself this year, it's about the women in the game. It's about who they are. It's about their stories. They're unashamedly being able to be themselves. And I think the content they're creating, the way they're talking about the growth of the game, the way they want to see it change and grow, is inspirational to loads of other young women and men who are engaged or not engaged, I should say, in rugby, because they sell it brilliantly. And ultimately, at the heart of it, you know, for me, the reason I love doing this job and doing it in sport is because at the end of the day, we're trying to get people to have fun. We're trying to get more people getting fit, getting healthy, having a laugh, making some friends, creating memories, and getting a bit muddy and you know, honestly, a bit roughed up on a Saturday playing rugby. And I think there's nothing more wonderful than that. And I think that kind of relates to most sports, to be honest. But rugby has got a special way of doing it.
I think football had its moment last year, women's football, when they won the game. And I think before that, everybody was cheering on because they saw that possibility. And I think it's great the way you've spelled it out, that the women's rugby team is working towards just showing up in the way they are and who they are. So you've already said one of the things that you love about your job. I'm going to ask you about three things that you love about your job.
Yeah. I happily give you three things. So I'd say number one is the diversity of what I do. So I get to engage with so many different people who are doing a multitude of different roles. And I love being able to stretch across different areas of how this organization runs, both to try and understand it better, but also to help different people in different roles achieve our inclusivity and diversity objectives together. So that's great. Second one is, I'd say I'd love this, and I also think it's a bit of a curse, which is I am deeply curious about people. I love hearing about different experiences and different backgrounds, which means this job is kind of suited to me. At the same time, unfortunately, a lot of underrepresented groups have had quite negative experiences. You have to carry quite a heavy load, which can sometimes be quite difficult to manage. And I'm not going to say I've got the answer how to manage it. Sorry, fellow IND practitioners out there. But we should continue to talk to each other, use each other as sounding boards, because it is a heavy load sometimes. But at the same time, I would not want to do that. I would not want to engage with more people and understand their backstories. And I suppose the third one, I mean, I'm going to have to kind of repeat what I've said. You know, ultimately, what's different about what I do here, and this is no slight on any of my previous ED&I roles, because I love aspects of working in the Big Four and working for a large global law firm. It's great. But understandably, their ultimate organizational objectives are commercial and financial. And in rugby, we have commercial and financial objectives. Of course we do. We need money to make sure we can run the game. But ultimately, we're trying to enrich lives, which is in our purpose, in our mission statement. We want more people to have fun, and we want people to come together. And you know, when that's implicit in your organizational purpose, and you get to do a job like mine, like the two things are inextricably linked. And so I'm not saying I have to continuously, you know, not necessarily fight for my role, but explain why it's important. I do have to do a bit of that, but at the same time, it's definitely easier in a sport where everyone wants to see more people playing their sport, engaging in the sport, supporting the sport, spending money in their sport, which makes it a little bit different to working in the corporate space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I get that. So we're on the last question. So end the sentence, I believe in.
I believe in positive intent. I don't believe the majority of people have a consistent negative outlook on life. I genuinely believe most people are well-intentioned. And I think there are some people who are malicious and they do cause issues. I think there are also people who perhaps just don't understand the impact of their words, their behaviours, and that therefore manifests in one end offence, the other end discrimination. And I think the more we can alert people to that and get them to lean into their positive intent, the better. So it sounds really cheesy, but I genuinely believe that most people are well-intentioned, want to do the right thing. And that's the thing that keeps me going.
Wow. That's a wonderful way to end this conversation. Thank you so much, Jatin. I think this is the first time I've spoken with somebody who works in sports and such a high profile category. Rugby is like very, very interesting. So thank you for all the insights and sharing your experiences. It's been such a wonderful conversation.
No, thank you for having me. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.